If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It was certainly the 6 weeks in his life where he felt most alive and most independent. You know, he was not a prince, he was not a king, he was a man on the run for his life, using his wits against his enemy.
That was Charles Spencer on location at Boscobel House, where Charles II hid from his pursuers.
Listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. For today's episode, our deputy editor, Charlotte Hodgman, paid a visit to Boscobel House in Shropshire, which is best known as the hiding place of Charles II, when he was on the run from Oliver Cromwell's forces after the Battle of Worcester in 1651. The story of Charles's flight to safety has recently been told by the historian and author Charles Spencer in his book To Catch a King. And so Charlotte invited him to join her at Boscobel to explore these dramatic events in more detail. And, as chance would have it, the visit took place on the anniversary of Charles II's stay at the house.
We're here at Boscobel, where Charles II famously stayed when he was on the run in 1651. Just before we sort of talk about this period of his life, perhaps it's worth going back to the Civil War itself. How much action in the Civil War did Charles actually see before he went into exile?
Well, surprisingly, because I think people have a view of Charles II very much as a sort of lazy, mistress-loving, horse-racing figure as king. But actually, in his youth, he was very active in the Civil War. He was a bystander, really, but sort of technically part of the Battle of Edgehill, the first big battle in 1642, and all the way through to the final great defeat of the Royalists in 1651. There was a sort of period where Charles I wanted to keep him by his side. And then as the war really fell apart, you know, after Naseby, etc., Charles I wanted his son to be away from him so that they weren't both killed or captured at the same time. So he was packed off to the southwest of England and was effectively the general in charge of the royalist forces in the southwest, although he had a lot of real soldiers who did the real work. But he was actually a very brave man in battle. We know that when he was preparing for a large sea battle in the end of the 1640s against the English fleet, his officers said, look, you go and make yourself safe down below. And he absolutely would have none of it. He wanted to be in the front line of any battle. Now, that battle was called off. But eyewitness accounts at the Battle of Worcester, where he was literally a day or two before he ended up here at Boscobel, they give the most thrilling account of his action. You know, he was a man of great bravery and leadership. And, you know, he got stuck in. He was, as a young man, I think he was very courageous, but and also a sort of seasoned soldier by the end of the Civil War.
Yeah, and it's worth mentioning that he was quite young at the time, you know, when he was sent down to the West Country.
Yes, he was a teenager. And even by the time of Worcester, where he was nominally commanding a large army, he was only in his very early 20s. And he was, you know, he enjoyed that side of things. And I think it is important to remember that. He wasn't just this fop with a court that, you know, was inundated with pleasure.
And, I mean, what was his relationship like with his parents? I mean, he seems to be a very, almost an opposite character to his father, Charles I.
Mm. Well, Charles wanted to control his character. He gave him a sort of council of very wise and staid men, because essentially Charles I was quite religious and a serious figure. And so he gave people like Edward Hyde, who became Lord Clarendon, as a sort of principal figure to guide him. But you have to remember, actually, because the royal family was so disparate at this time in geographically, and after 1646, you know, the last 3 years of Charles I's life, they didn't see each other, Charles I and the future Charles II. And it was a time, really, of intense trial for the royal family because of the way the Civil War was going. Mm. They were all suffering in different ways. You know, when Henrietta Maria left the southwest of England, it was with parliamentary ships firing at her. And James, a future James II, having to escape the country dressed as a girl to get out of imprisonment in St. James's. And, you know, and another little girl, Princess Elizabeth, dying in Carisbrooke Castle, tragically, because she was kept in quite close imprisonment down there. So all in all, it's important to remember that this country suffered enormously then. It was the bloodiest conflict in terms of loss of life against the population. It was even bloodier in those terms than the First World War. Mm. And the royal family itself was certainly not immune to the suffering that was prevalent at the time.
No, because, I mean, he probably wouldn't have known his siblings all very well because they were scattered so, you know, and the youngest baby was actually left behind, wasn't she, by her mother?
She was. And she eventually was got safely away by a rather sort of daring lady-in-waiting who smuggled her across. But, yeah, they really, you know, they were at the sharp end of the Civil War. I mean, literally in Charles I's case. But, you know, it was a tough time for everyone.
Yeah. Was he sent away from England in 1646?
Well, yes, it was a difficult... It became very controversial as to what to do with him because he was so important symbolically as well as, you know, just keeping him alive was very important. And so there was one faction of old-fashioned English statesmen who wanted him to remain in crown dominion. So he started in the Scilly Isles and he went to Jersey. But then there was Henrietta Maria, the Queen, was desperate to get him to France. She was a French princess and she thought that she could help the royalist cause with him there, maybe marry him off to a powerful heiress who could bring an army or money to the cause. But the last thing that these staid Protestant statesmen wanted was to have their Prince of Wales brought up by France. You know, that was the old enemy.
Yeah, and presumably he would be brought up as a Catholic.
They were terrified of that. And in fact, Charles I was absolutely adamant about that. He said to Charles II, obey your mother in everything except religion. Not allowed to do that. And but Henrietta Maria had it as an absolute fixation of her life was to bring up her children in a Catholic way if she could. And she got permission from the Pope when she married this Protestant prince, Charles I, that she would really be a subversive enemy on behalf of Catholicism in Britain. Mm. So that made her very unpopular, particularly with the Puritans in Parliament. But, you know, it was religion being so important at this time, of course, that trying to keep Charles II away from Roman Catholicism was really a key part of a lot of the Royalists' principles.
Yeah. I mean, what was life like for him in exile? He was at the French court for a while.
Well, I find his life in exile really pathetic, and I think it led to his doomed attempt to get the crown back, because that had to be better. Even with limited chances, it had to be better than the life he had been leading for 5 years. So he went to Jersey, and the governor there, a man called Carteret, tried to make him feel that he was still royal, even though he had a tiny retinue and no power. And there are wonderful eyewitness accounts of these very elaborate banquets, with Charles being served all of the best things while literally alone at a table with everyone watching him eat, and one servant on his knee offering bread throughout the dinner, and another with a handkerchief ready to mop his mouth. And I mean, really, you know, absurd, given that he was basically a fugitive. And then he was packed off. Eventually, his mother managed to secure his presence in the French court. And we think of Charles as this great sort of sophisticated womanizer. Well, he really wasn't at this stage. He was a very gawky teenager. And when he was put next to the most powerful and wealthy heiress, she was a princess of France called Madame de Montpensier. And the whole hope was that they would get together. And she wrote these fantastic accounts of quite how gauche she was. And the whole table, everyone leaving them and him sitting there without uttering a word for 15 minutes. So he wasn't very good at seduction. And he felt really, I think he felt very emasculated by the whole experience. And also at the same time, his mother treated him as a little boy, even though he wasn't one. And she was very conscious of her status. And she used to make him take his hat off in her presence, which was very unusual for a prince of his eminence. And she made sure that the pension that came to him through France went through her. She basically gave him pocket money. And it was really awful for him. And then at the same time, there was the constant question of how could he get his throne back? His father had died. As many of his father's beliefs were, you know, tricky ones to subscribe to, but at least he died as a man of principle. He hadn't sacrificed his religious beliefs to keep his crown or his head. But Charles II was convinced that the only way he could possibly get on the throne again was by going into an alliance with somebody who wasn't in tune with the Church of England, really. And eventually, having hoped he could do it with Ireland and their Catholics, he ended up having to go for the Scots and their Presbyterians. And it was very controversial. I mean, you know, the courtiers I've mentioned already, the old school, Clarendon, etc., they just would have nothing to do with this venture because they thought it was against principles. And actually, there was a sort of, it's quite odd for us because you'd have thought you just do anything to get the crown back. But these sophisticated men of traditional values were saying that we'd rather not be in power than have you in power with the help of people who are totally against our religion.
So he really sort of sold out, didn't he, to get the crown back?
He did sell out. And the great victim of this was the great royalist champion in Scotland, the Marquess of Montrose. So Charles used Montrose, who had had a string of amazing victories in the earlier civil wars with small forces against much larger parliamentary and covenant Scots. And he used him as a bargaining chip. He said, please come back and help my cause in Scotland. And Montrose did it in good faith. But actually, Charles was just trying to keep the pressure on his Scottish, the people who were trying to woo him into a Scottish alliance, by saying, well, I want to settle on better terms, and my champion is back fighting me. Montrose is back fighting me in Scotland. And then there's this very poignant moment where Charles knows that Montrose is going to have to be sacrificed for the cause of his new alliance. And he sends him a letter, including a sort of the news that he's going to be made a Knight of the Garter, the highest chivalric order. But at the same time, it's sort of the kiss of death, because he's saying, I've got to ally with these, your enemies. And sure enough, very soon afterwards, Montrose was captured and taken through the streets of Edinburgh and wasn't allowed the traditional nobleman's execution by an axe, but was hanged. And I'm afraid that is one of the more shameful moments in Charles II's life.
Do we know how he felt about that, about sort of betraying this Montrose?
I think he felt appalled by it, but at the same time, he felt he had to do the right thing for the crown. And I love the visual element of these stories, you know, and when Charles is coming through Scotland, he arrives in the north of Scotland, he's coming south to get to the power base of Edinburgh. And he passes through, I think it's Edinburgh, and he says, oh, what's that on the gate? Some strange object. And it was one of Montrose's arms.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say that, yeah.
Yes, had been nailed up high as a deterrent. So it was certainly, you know, the fact that he had betrayed Montrose was not something he could forget.
No. So you mentioned that he sort of entered into this partnership with the Presbyterians in Scotland. What did they want in exchange for help?
Well, it's hard for us to understand at this distance how intense their religious belief was. You know, there's a man called Lord Warriston, who was one of the main figures in the Scottish Calvinists, extreme Calvinists. And he was a man who liked to sleep very short hours so that he could have extra time to pray. And he used to pray for hours by himself. You know, that's what he did. There was one account of what he started first thing in the morning and he forgot the day. He was still praying sort of 12, 14 hours later because he was in such an intense place. And then on top of that, I mean, you did not want to be a dinner guest at his house because grace could go on for an hour before you got your food. So you're dealing with people of such fundamental faith. I mean, there are, you know, there are echoes of it around the world today where you believe in your God so intensely that nothing else matters. So they believed that even a king was just another sinner who should be under God's law. And they, in the Kirk, the sort of Scottish assembly, as it were, they would oversee his moral rights, his morality, actually, as much as any other human being. So he was really, a king was viewed as a sort of magistrate rather than a divine appointment.
So the divine rights was not something that was adhered to by, you know, they didn't think he was appointed by God.
Not at all. They believed that he had to do God's duty, otherwise he was capable of removal from office, really.
And that's quite at odds with, you know, Charles I had a very strong sense of his divine right, didn't he?
Yes.
Did Charles II, did he feel the same, you know, about that?
Well, he did. We know, I mean, later in his, when he was crowned, you know, he did do the sort of rather odd things, touching for the king's evil. He believed he had, because of his divine appointment, the ability to cure people from their illness. Mm. So he definitely believed that, but it wasn't in a political way, I don't think. I mean, he realised he had to suffer a loss of dignity to have the Scots on side. And Charles I would never countenance that. Also, I have to say, Charles I realised exactly what I said earlier, which was that, you know, to ally yourself with Scottish Presbyterianism was to lose your power as king, because that it just they wouldn't have the same reverence for him. Mm. And that was very difficult for Charles because he thought he was letting God down. And Charles I was adamant that in Scotland he really did want bishops there because he again believed that they were appointed by God as his officers, you know. And, you know, it's very intense. You think England and Scotland, they were so different in their religious belief. Yes, there were obviously extreme Puritans down here, but the breadth of support for extreme Calvinism in Scotland was very surprising.
Mm. It's ironic, really, because a lot of the causes for the Civil War in the first place had sort of stemmed around Scotland and its relationship with England. And then here's Charles II coming to them for help.
Yes.
To get the throne back.
And that was very difficult for a lot of the royalists. Mm. They did not like that idea at all. So it was really Charles II's people really fell into two camps. One who saw themselves as pragmatists. This was the only way they were going to get the crown back. There was no other way. And others who thought, well, if there's another way, then if there isn't another way, we just have to suck it up, really. Yeah. You know. I don't know. In a way, in my book, I try and actually look at it almost as a sort of pull on Charles's conscience. And his conscience is personified by Edward Hyde, later Earl of Clarendon, who is so clear that you do not do alliances with these people. And in a way, the background to the story is that Charles sells his principles out to get the Scots to help him. And almost this 6 weeks on the run is a sort of odyssey, at the end of which he turns his back really on the influence of his mother and those who've said you should ally with the wrong people. And he turns to Edward Hyde until, you know, 6 or 7 years into his reign as his main advisor, because he was right. It didn't work having the Scots come in. I think one of the problems for Charles, he hadn't understood, you know, he's a cosmopolitan figure and he was King of Scotland and he was a Stuart. And he thought, well, when I lead my Scottish army into England, we'll be welcomed by English royalists. But most English royalists just saw an invading Scottish army, which they'd seen before and not enjoyed. So Charles was seeing things in a much more cosmopolitan way than your average Englishman, who thought, oh, my God, it's the Scots again. And they had a terrible reputation for, you know, rape and pillage, and not all of it deserved, but that was the reputation. And part of the story, actually, which is so interesting, is how the Civil War developed the propaganda sheets, the news sheets, the magazines and news reports. They proliferated in a massive way as propaganda instruments. And people listened to them. You know, they really did believe the stories that were put to them mainly by the printing presses in London, which were controlled by Parliament.
And I suppose people were probably just heartily sick of fighting and war and, you know, to have the prospect of another fight.
It's true. I think the figure is something like 200,000 Englishmen died because of the First and Second Civil War, either from direct conflict or from battle-borne diseases, etc. And people had just had enough. I mean, even in Oxford, which was the royalist capital in the First and Second Civil War, you have people there manning the defences in case they assumed Charles was headed there rather than for Worcester, to have a launching pad of going from Oxford into London. And so even ultra-royalist Oxford turned its back on Charles II. It just wasn't the right time.
Was Charles also driven by anger at, you know, his father being beheaded, which was, you know, would have created shockwaves, you know, across Europe? It's a huge thing to have happened. Was anger behind his kind of wanting to come back and get the throne back?
Definitely the case. So in his declaration of why he was coming, one was because he felt he was the rightful king, of course. But I think the third reason he gave was to deal with the murderers of his father, as he called them. And this was something that stayed with him, you know. And when he eventually came back in 1660, he came back on a platform that had been negotiated of reconciliation. You know, half the country had fought against his family. What are you going to do about that? You have to forgive. But he left a clause in the agreement that said, but of course I cannot be expected to forget the men who murdered my father, of which there were sort of 80. I mean, 59 who signed the death warrant, but also the officers of the court and the people who were officers at the beheading. So, and Charles never, ever got over these people doing that to his father, understandably. But even, I mean, he died in 1685. Up until that date, people were scouring the east coast of America looking for runaway regicides, as these killers of the king were known. So, no, he never got over that. And he tried very hard, rather dramatically. He tried to rescue his father by submitting to Parliament, when he knew his father was going to be on trial, a piece of paper with just his signature at the bottom. It really was the ultimate carte blanche, where he would have agreed to any terms to save his father's life. And we know from eyewitness accounts that when Charles II received the news of his father's death, while his courtiers were in total shock, he was really screaming in agony at it.
Mm, gosh. So the decision is made then to return to Britain, and he lands in Scotland, you say.
Yes.
How is he received in Scotland? Is he received as a king, or?
Well, he's received as a sort of king without power. Mm. Until he's totally agreed to all of the Calvinist terms, they say, well, you are nominally king, but we won't let you actually rule until you've had to do really degrading things, such as say how appalling his parents were, and it was their sins that had caused the Civil War and caused the defeats. And he had to repent for his own actions. I mean, to be honest, he wasn't a Calvinist's ideal ruler. I mean, he already had a bit of a reputation for having a fairly wild private life. And they were aware of this. And actually, there's a rather poignant bit I found of one of the negotiators who managed to persuade Charles to agree to the terms, sort of almost flagellating himself, saying, we've done a terrible thing because we're making this young prince promise things which he doesn't believe. And this in itself is a sin. So, yes, he paid lip service to what was required of him by the Scots. And but they never trusted each other. And in fact, a year before this tale, he went on the run away from them. And it's quite an interesting moment. It was called The Start. He pretended he was going on a hunting trip, but then he bolted north and trying to head for the Highlands for other supporters to get away from the Calvinists. And it was a terrible escape because they eventually found Charles sort of sobbing under a mattress in a hovel. And it's quite a nice juxtaposition because actually the escape, which I write about after Worcester, is one of great daring and heroism, etc. But to place that against, I'm afraid, a not very manly episode a year earlier is quite interesting. And I put that down actually to the people around this house, you know, we're at Boscobel now. But the sort of yeoman farmer family, the Pendrells, who looked after him, when he was trying to get away on the first night after the defeat, he did his usual thing of sort of feeling really sorry for himself and sobbing and saying he couldn't go on. But this solid sort of, you know, hardworking peasant farmer said, well, you're not giving up on me now. We're going to do this. Mm. And he needed that. He needed somebody to give him the backbone to go on. And then actually he learns the way to be a successful fugitive incredibly quickly, but he hadn't got it in himself, I don't believe. It was the support network that he stumbled across that gave him a chance.
Yeah. Worcester, the Battle of Worcester was kind of the last straw, really, wasn't it, for him?
Yes.
When he came south to gather support in England. What had made him think that there was so much support for him still in England?
It was wishful thinking. There was no evidence for it at all. But what he actually, to be fair to him, what he didn't know was how brilliant the parliamentarians were at giving him no chance at all. So they had imprisoned anyone they thought was a real royalist threat. They imprisoned. Those who were sort of dubious weren't allowed to leave. They were only allowed to stay within 5 miles of their houses. Lots of their weapons had been confiscated. And also, you know, the royalists had been pummeled and pummeled for a decade. Mm. Certainly after 1644, things had not gone well for them. And so a lot of people just waited to see. If there'd been a royalist victory early on, then they might have come to him. But the very first thing happened in Lancashire at Wigan Lane. The only sizable English force that would have joined Charles was under the Earl of Derby, and they were surprised by a parliamentary force. You know, the New Model Army was a very effective military machine, and they were up against, I mean, Earl of Derby's retainers from the Isle of Man with sort of, you know, very basic weapons and no real training. It was a real mismatch. And so Charles, I think, learned as he went along, he was amazed. None of the cities or towns opened their gates to his men. And the leading Scottish commanders, the main one was a man called General Leslie. They were sort of shrugging their shoulders all the way, saying, this is going to be a disaster. And sure enough, it was. And the parliamentarians were very efficient at raising their men. They closed the way back to Scotland. They just gently nudged Charles's forces further and further away from any hope. He was only going to stop at Worcester to just have a break because the men were exhausted. Worcester opened its gates. It was a great royalist stronghold in the Civil Wars. It had been one of the last places on the mainland to surrender, etc. And I think Charles realised, they say he realised that if he left Worcester, it would have suffered terribly for having been so royalist. And he felt so honour-bound to stay there and try and make a, a hand of it. But, you know, he had 16,000 men, and Parliament managed to pull together probably the largest army on English soil ever, in the high 30,000s. I mean, of course, there are the Battle of Towton or whatever, and we don't really know, and Boadicea, we really don't know. But the largest army that is properly recorded, and, you know, the Scottish cavalry took one look at this and thought, well, we're not going to get involved in this. And so they left. And although it was a very hard-fought battle, Cromwell said it was the toughest one he'd ever been in for a while, largely down to Charles's bravery as a leader. It was only really going to go one way. Mm. And they were really butchered in the thousands. And the parliamentary casualties were negligible.
I mean, it's not a battle that you read a lot about, though, is it?
Not at all. It's completely, well, it's not completely forgotten. It's very much a footnote of history. Mm-hmm. Although in America, it's always had a greater significance. So in the 1780s, the great presidents, Adams and Jefferson, came to visit England, and they went on a sort of pilgrimage of places that really mattered to them. And Adams wrote, he couldn't believe, even then, people had forgotten about Worcester, and he said, this is holy land because of liberty being won here. And he said, it's holier land than any church in England. And he was appalled by the fact that we had forgotten it then. Well, certainly now it's really forgotten.
Yeah.
But it was the absolute end of the royalist military threat. And actually, it was Cromwell's final battle. And it was sort of the end of it. Because before that, you know, for the 2 years between Charles I's execution and the Battle of Worcester, 2.5 years, the Commonwealth was not established at all. It could have gone either way, and it just set the seal on letting Cromwell eventually sort of get stuck in as Lord Protector. It was the decisive battle.
And this is the point when Charles is a fugitive. He goes on the run, doesn't he? How do they get away from the battle? I mean, what's the plan?
Well, it was Charles's real brilliance was right at the beginning. So he, first of all, when he was fleeing Worcester, he kept stopping his horse and saying, come on, we've got to go back. And luckily, a lot of sort of experienced soldiers around him said, no, that was it. We've been utterly defeated. Mm-hmm. And so there wasn't really a plan as such, because, of course, he hadn't known he'd be overwhelmed like that. What he hadn't realised was that the parliamentarians knew they were going to win the battle very easily. And they had put a net around Worcester so that they could capture the Scots on their way home. And they were very effective. I mean, very, very few people got away. This is one of the amazing things is Charles is one of so few who got away from the Battle of Worcester. And yet he was 6'2" when people weren't. He had quite dark skin. He's quite distinctive. They called him the Black Boy in some of the news sheets. That's who they were looking for because his mother was French-Italian. And you read these news sheets and there's not really a worry about it. They assume he's dead and he's probably among the stripped bodies, which, you know, after the battle, who knew? There were sort of 3,000 bodies lying there. He could have been one of them. And then they think, well, we're not finding him among the bodies. And it then becomes really important to them because, again, if they are going to establish the Commonwealth, they need to catch him and kill him. He would definitely have been killed. Mm. And so this urgency, in fact, the main person looking for him is a really good baddie. He's called Major General Thomas Harrison, and he's this zealot of a Puritan who has escorted Charles I from near the Isle of Wight to his place of trial in London. And so he's put in charge of hunting him down, and he's done really well. I mean, they keep bringing enormous numbers of prisoners because Charles had recognised this. His men had totally lost their nerve. So you have hundreds of royalists on the run surrendering to 30 parliamentarians because they just lost it. Their morale is shot. And Charles, literally in the first hour of fleeing, he sees defeat in everyone's eyes. And he just decides, right, I'm going to get away from these people. They didn't fight very well before I was beaten. They're certainly not going to do any good now. And he thinks, but I will need a companion. And he looks around and he's got a sort of, a fast-living sort of courtier friend who was a very effective royalist general called Henry, Lord Wilmot. And he says to Wilmot, I want to head for London. I think that's the cleverest thing to do. First of all, massive population there. and also lots of ships to get to France. So a good place to hide. And all the others are thinking, no, let's get back to Scotland. And almost none of them make it. And Wilmot and him decide to meet at certain places. They have a plan, a vague plan of getting to London. And I think that was Charles's genius. He got rid of all of the defeated and analysed the one man who was brave, and I have to say, sort of foolhardy enough to take on this impossible enterprise.
Because it must have been very tempting just to kind of say, throw his hands up and say, I've done my best, you know, I give up.
Well, it is interesting because I think he knew what would... I think it would have been certain death. Yeah. So that, but I think he certainly knew that the cause was over. There's one moment in his escape where after lots of... I mean, it was really tough, the escape. I mean, we think of him... If you go past one of the pubs, I think there's 400 pubs in England called the Royal Oak. And if you go past them, there's always him in a sort of, you know, cavalier kit, sort of hiding in a tree, looking very relaxed. It wasn't like that at all. It was brutal. You know, he was on the run for the first few days, no sleep. Or hardly any sleep. And this is a man, you've got to remember, who had been used to, I mean, this is a detail, but used to the finest footwear. Mm. And suddenly he's using a sort of peasant's really rough shoes. And his feet are just cut to ribbons, running around the countryside, around these parts of Shropshire and Staffordshire. And he's in agony from the word go. But he's tough and he's adaptable. And once he understands that there is a network. Around here, there was a Roman Catholic network who could help. He very quickly realised that. He knew that they had methods of hiding priests, such as priest holes in the building, that he could probably use. So he was clever enough to recognise that they could be his salvation. But once he got into that, he learnt very quickly how to just get through it, really.
Mm. It's interesting you say that he had support from Catholics, even though... he had done this deal with the Scots, which presumably would have caused more persecution for Catholics in England. They were still willing to help him.
They were. So, I mean, the vast majority of Catholics in England were royalist because they had such a fear of the Puritans. So they had a residual loyalty. And in fact, the families that he fell into here, so this wonderful family, the Pendrells, of which five brothers helped him, they had fought in the Royalist army, and there was a massive crossover between Catholicism and serving the crown. And they were... It's quite interesting for us to read this in the 21st century, you know, the reverence they had for him as a divinely appointed king. I mean, they really thought they had been entrusted by God with this wonderful privilege of helping the king on the run. And then you read, you know, the Puritans calling him Charles Stuart, and they just want to chop his head off. It really does distill the two sides in the Civil War. These men who think this is the greatest possible privilege to help him, and the others who think we've got to kill this man because he's going to destroy our country.
Yeah, and they were willing to risk their lives for him. You know, they would have been killed too if they'd been.
Yes, one of them was not one of the Pendrells, but one of their brothers-in-law was caught and interrogated. And refused to give anything up about when he had last seen the king. And he was hanged in Oxford. And it would definitely have happened to the others. And in fact, right at the end of the escape, even the famous Jane Lane, who was a lady whose horse he rode on and pretending to be a servant, they were looking for her to bring her in for imprisonment. And you know, it was tough then. I mean, right at the end, you find out that some of the people who were royalists, even though they were women, they were tortured. There's a woman who was burnt every day with sort of coals, etc. Because, you know, we think of people being very sort of charming and civilized in those days, but it was brutal. And especially if you could hate somebody because of their religion or whatever, it made it okay to do brutal things.
Yeah.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/historyextra. Just go to Indeed.com/historyextra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
So tell me how he ended up here at Boscobel.
After Worcester, he was on the run, and there was a man he liked who had joined him, a local nobleman called Lord Talbot. And Talbot said, we should go to Boscobel. And at the same time, one of Charles's main lieutenants was the Earl of Derby, who had been wounded in a skirmish up in Lancashire at Wigan Lane. And he had managed to find a hiding place here before Worcester, and he recommended it as well. So Charles was heading for Boscobel, and then for some reason, Boscobel was in thick woodland then, as the name suggests. I mean, it means in beautiful woodland in Italian. Somebody, we don't know who, decided, actually, there's an even better hiding place. It's called White Ladies, which is, it was the ruins of an old priory with some sort of quite basic houses on it. So he went to White Ladies, and then from there he tried to get to the River Severn, because he felt that if he could get to Wales, there was a lot of royalist support there. But he found that was completely closed. And then he came back and he came to Boscobel, because the same family, basically, were serving in both houses. And here he found one of the great heroes of the piece, a man called Major Carless, or Careless, depends on the spelling at the time. He was spelt that way too, who had been one of the figures who had helped Charles escape from Worcester. So to cover Charles's escape, a dozen or so officers kept attacking down the street, the main street in Worcester, to hold back the parliamentarians. And this included Carless or Careless. And he got away. He was the last man out of Worcester. And he had been hiding in these parts. And he's the one who came up with this brilliant idea of hiding in the oak tree. He'd used it. He'd been on the run for quite a long time in this area. And he was a native of this part of the world. And he said, look, if there is only one place, if you stay in a house, doesn't matter how good the priest hold, they will find you. Mm. And they spent a day up the tree, the famous royal oak, of which a descendant still exists today. And it was just one of those, it was just an amazingly lush tree. And Charles saw people looking for him. He went to sleep. He was so exhausted. He went to sleep in the major's arms. And there was a moment when the major realised that there were parliamentary troops right below the tree. And he felt, because Charles had been lying on him for such a long time, he realised that he had lost all sensation in his leg, and that they were both going to slide out in front of the enemy. So he had to pinch the king while not allowing him to make a noise to just say, you've got to move, because otherwise we're dead. And so that this is the most lyrical part of the tale, is the hiding in the oak tree. And to Charles, it became an incredibly important symbol of this 6 weeks, his most, it was certainly the 6 weeks in his life where he felt most alive and most independent. You know, he was not a prince. He was not a king. He was a man on the run for his life, using his wits against his enemy. And so when he came back in 1660, one of the very first things he did on the ship coming back to England was to tell a group of people, you won't know the true story, but this is what happened in those 6 weeks. And among those first people to hear the tale from the king's mouth was Samuel Pepys, the famous diarist. And Pepys basically became an investigative journalist, really. And over the next 25 years, 23 years, actually, but he tracked down all the main people who had supported Charles on the run and took their accounts of what had happened. And if you think about it, you know, you're leading a humdrum life in Shropshire, Staffordshire, or any one of the 10 counties that he passed through. You would remember every detail of what happened, the half day or the 3 days that you helped preserve the king's liberty and life. Yeah. And so part of my job, actually, as writing this, was to, some of them are conflicting, was to work out who was closest to the action when they're reporting this, and which is the most sort of authentic voice. And it was an incredible thing to read these words and to read the detail. I love that there's one man who remembers sitting there and opening a bottle of cider, and out flew two hornets. And you just think, it's just so visual, isn't it? And it's just, but you would remember that because nothing else is, I mean, what else is, you know, you buy a good heifer on market day. I mean, there's not many things to go in the diary, is there? Really?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the accounts, as you sort of said, there's a lot of food involved and things like that, the detail, but not an awful lot about the how people were feeling about and perhaps how Charles felt about.
Yes, I that's a great shame, actually, when you're writing about this period. I mean, Charles II was a man of his sensuous tastes, and so it's endless things about what he ate or didn't eat and how hungry he was or whatever, but very big descriptions about that from him to Pepys, because Pepys was eventually allowed an audience with him and took notes of what the king remembered. But I'm afraid I think it was to do with the fact that Charles felt it was unbecoming to share the fact that he was frightened or nervous or whatever. So he just glossed over that. And that's very... So you have to leave it as self-evident, really, that, you know, when he's being chased down a sort of a lane through the mud, then his heart was going.
Yeah.
But he doesn't write about that. I think he thought it was not dignified to write about feelings.
I mean, we've walked out to the tree today.
Yes.
And just being out there, you know, it's very atmospheric. You can imagine how scary it would have been to be in that tree and looking down and seeing, you know, soldiers who wanted to kill you.
It must have been an amazing... I mean, literally... On the 3rd of September, he was King of Scotland, hoping to be King of England, in command of a large army. And then within a matter of hours, he was the most hunted man in the country. And being disguised as a woodman, you know, haircut, suit, and all of that sort of thing. And it must have been a shock of a huge magnitude. And also, he must have realised straight away that was it for the royalist cause. You know, they played their last card. So there must have been a depression as well. I think just the life or death struggle kept him going because, I mean, there was no doubt what was going to happen if they caught him. And in fact, you know, he'd already been declared a traitor. He was already guilty of high treason. They wouldn't even have needed a court except to process the charge if they'd needed to. But he was done if he was caught.
And there was a price on his head, wasn't there, for people to turn him in? So he didn't know who was going to be, who was friend or foe that he was meeting.
He was so shocked when he found out somebody had been at a fair and they had heard a proclamation condemning him and offering £1,000 for his capture. This is such a huge sum. I mean, even if you convert it, you know, there are ways of converting what 1651, £1,000 meant, but it doesn't really get across the massive nature of it. So even when major generals of his were caught, the reward was £50. So the fact that he was 20 times that, and he got very upset when he learnt from these people who were looking after him, the Penderels, that there was £1,000, because he thought, well, of course they're going to hand me in for that, because anyone would. And Major Curlis says, no, I just want you to know, if we were offered 100 times, we wouldn't do it. And it is interesting, the intense loyalty that some of these people felt to the king, because actually there's these moments where, you know, he's sitting in an inn or whatever, and people come up and say, I know who you are, but I'm not going to betray you, you know, because to them, it was almost a religious mission to save the king, and they would condemn themselves forever. When he was here... in the White Lady's Boscobel area, they're only a mile or so apart. So when he was actually in White Ladies and he's saying goodbye to all his commanding officers and his household, they all begged him not to tell him what his plans were because they didn't want the eternal shame of being tortured and revealing any detail. So they all just said, do not tell us what you're going to do.
Yeah. I mean, he would have been lost without them, wouldn't he?
Yes.
We're actually sitting in the attic now, aren't we, with the priest hole that he actually stayed in.
And yes.
We just happened to be here on the anniversary of when he stayed.
I know, it's extraordinary. That is a real coincidence. But yes, he turned up here on this day in 1651. Priest holes were these incredible constructs. They were master priest hole makers, these sort of craftsmen, of which the most interesting one is this man called Nicholas Owen, who was a carpenter from Oxford, but his real work happened at night. And the priest hole was, it would only have been known where it was and how it was accessed by the man of the house and the man who made it. Mm. Nobody else would have known how to access it. And they prided themselves, the really good makers of priest holes, pride in themselves and never doing the same one twice, because of course once one had been found then they would use the same formula to find the next. But the really crafty ones were the ones which were a sort of, I don't know how they thought of them, because of course there wouldn't have been a written plan, but thinking in 3D of how to have one curling around inside the wall of a building is very clever. But this one is it's a very good priest hole, but it's a standard, you know, it's down below the floorboards sort of thing. And there would have been ways of concealing it. But Charles was so big, he found the priest holes really, most of them very tough because he was 6'2" and it was just a very difficult for him to even lie down. So you find him at various stages. He would have been in the room next door, but with the priest hole ready to go, as it were, because it was so uncomfortable for him.
So what he's at Bosco just for a couple of days in this area. Where does he go after? What's the new plan?
Well, when he realises that Wales isn't an option because Parliament's closed it effectively, there's soldiers everywhere, he's still hoping to go to London, but the people around here, it's such a quiet sort of local area. They only know other royalists in this area, so there's no way they can help him get to London. And so he, while he's in this area, one of the other Pendrell brothers, these five brothers, is helping his sidekick, Lord Wilmot, to get away. And that's very difficult because Lord Wilmot refused to wear a disguise. So he looked really like a cavalry commander from the Royalist forces and he endless sort of close scrapes. But then by complete chance, they bump into a priest, a Roman Catholic priest called Father Huddleston, who's one of the great characters in this story. And Huddleston says, okay, well, maybe I can help Wilmot, that is, because they were separate at this stage, Wilmot and Charles. And he takes Wilmot in at another house, not that far from here. And eventually, it's a terrible problem for, you have to remember the state of communications at this time. There is a sort of, that's the great plus for Charles, in that his enemies can't communicate effectively or quickly when tracking him down. Mm. But at the same time, he's very isolated. And he and Wilmot almost miss each other so many times, you think they're never going to meet up again. But they eventually do meet up. And so really what happens is, this is what I would call the Roman Catholic underground, Boscobel, White Ladies, this area. It's all the Catholics help in a sort of like an underground resistance movement to hide him. But then the next chapter really is a series of colonels who have served in the Royalist army, who know each other and trust each other. And they provide a separate network to get into the next phase. So it's quite, I actually broke the book down. It's almost like acts in a play, because this is so distinctive. This, you know, yeoman farmers from a Catholic background with the gentry thrown in. And then this officer class of old royalists who sort of salute each other and help each other. It's very much sort of Three Musketeers stuff. They then take it on from there. And then it sort of goes sideways after that. I mean, one of the things is, yes, it lasted 6 weeks, this time on the run. But there are so many times where you think, he's going to get away now, because it just had to be the case. And then something goes very wrong at the last moment. And so it's, that's where I really admire Charles, because I think it's one thing to have your hopes dashed once, but to have them repeatedly dashed and to keep going is quite impressive. But actually, I think he shares the credit for that with the, he was just incredibly lucky with the people he fell in with who were, they were determined to get him away.
Yeah. I suppose the longer he's in England for, the greater the chance of him being found. And
absolutely. And, you know, by the end, I mean, they're almost tripping over him by the end.
Yeah.
They don't, they know roughly where he is. And, you know, it's one of those, the story reads like, not my version of it, but the story itself reads like fiction, because you can't believe that he just gets away from this and just. And what's incredible really to me is that at the end, it's all rather sort of mundane. He just gets on a ship and goes to France. Yeah.
Was it from Bristol he went in the end?
Well, no, he tried to go through Bristol, but it's amazing, really, because you think of Bristol. Bristol was the second port. Mm. I mean, London by far the biggest, but Bristol was very big too. And when he sort of researches there isn't a ship going to France or Spain for the next month. And you just think, what on earth's going on? But that was the case.
Yeah.
And actually, somebody has this brilliant idea. Thinking laterally, they think, well, look, there's nothing going from these parts for this period from English ships, but there must be French ships returning. So they find a French merchant who then finds another way. So it's sort of, they then head more towards the Brighton area and all that.
But, and that's it then. That's the you know, the fight for the throne is over, well, temporarily.
Well, yes. And then Charles goes back to a really sort of terrible life. I mean, yes, there's massive celebrations among the royalists around Europe, and particularly the French can't believe he's back and, he's escaped. But very soon it all becomes pathetic again. And so, you know, the great hero, his sidekick, Lord Wilmot, rather than being able to fight for the king, is sort of going around courts in Germany begging for money to keep the king afloat. There's the odd sort of hopeless rebellion, which goes nowhere. But he doesn't come back through any great credit or virtue in him. He comes because Cromwell dies unexpectedly on the 7th anniversary of the Battle of Worcester, which is also Cromwell's birthday. And suddenly, there's no one to fill that void. There's nobody who has control of Parliament and the respect of the new model army. There are lots of very decent people out there, but they can't combine the two. And so over 18 months, power in England unravels. There's civil unrest. And people think, well, what do we do? And they think, well, we might as well have a king again.
Mm.
And he's invited back. So, and one of the main men who helps him is there when Charles appears. And he's amazed. He says the contrast between when I was helping the king escape a few years back and everyone wanted to kill him, and now they all want to be the loudest cheering for him reappearing, because nobody wants to be tainted by past association with Parliament. They all want to, everyone's sort of pretending it never really happened. And the scenes in London when he reappears on his 30th birthday and then for his coronation after that, They're apparently among the most jubilant scenes this country's ever seen. And it was because everyone was exhausted, you know, after nearly 20 years of civil turmoil and military bloodletting and repression and, you know, no Christmas at some stage and all this sort of thing, that you can suddenly get back to being, you know, part of the Republic's gone and you're back to what you know, which is a royal family, and he seems a really good guy. But of course, he was very disappointing very quickly. He wasn't a good king. He was very charming. He's very lazy. And very quickly, people realise, oh my God, he's not the saviour we hope for. And some tolerated that and some were really upset about it. But when he came back, it was like Obama's presidency for the first time when he was welcomed. It was that sort of moment you thought everything's changed and it's always going to be perfect.
That was Charles Spencer. To Catch a King, Charles II's Great Escape, is out now in the UK, published by William Collins. And in the US, it will be released next May by the same publisher. Boscobel House is open for visitors. Find out more details at English-Heritage.com. historyextra.org.uk. And you can read more from Charles and Charlotte in the December edition of BBC History magazine, which is on sale now with Lettice Knowles and Elizabeth I on the cover. Well, that's about it for today, but please do join us again on Thursday, where we'll be talking to Sasha Handley about the history of sleeping.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.